Hello and welcome to The Hand Cell, where interesting people tell us about books that they think we should read. I'm Jen Worthington. I'm coming to you from Book Riot. And today's guest is Julian Uggen, author of the recently published No Country for Eight Spot Butterflies. Welcome, Julian.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate being on.
Yeah, we're so excited to talk to you. You are a very interesting person. The definition of an interesting person. So if you would you tell our listeners a little bit about who you are as a reader as well as an author?
Okay, sure. So, you know, as a reader, I live for sentences, you know, sometimes like I remember entire books because of a single sentence that was just, I don't know, left me breathless and changed, you know, and then sometimes I love a really good story, you know, and I can kind of forgive, you know, the writing, even when it's, I don't know, there's no restraint or whatever, but the story's so good, I'm in, you know, it's just sometimes, you know, it just sort of depends. And I'm totally open to different genres. Although like lately I've been reading a ton of nonfiction, which is in part because I'm writing my own sort of a nonfiction collection. Mm-hmm. Having just written one and writing one more now, it's just, I don't know, it's important for me to just sort of hear and listen to what sort of my colleagues are saying, especially those who are writing around the same topics, for example, the climate crisis.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's really important to me. So I just finished like a ton of books on that topic. But yes, today though, I totally picked books that were not about the climate crisis, not directly, at least two of the three, because I've also, for me anyway, as a reader, sometimes fiction is just so necessary too, because fiction does something, you know, it just does something really important that it just sort of worries the edges, you know, of your, not only literary, but your political and your moral imagination.
Yeah.
And I think that's super critical, especially now, because when we're facing such daunting challenges, like the climate crisis,
yes,
it's so necessary to realize that the world can be bigger than what you are told to believe.
Yes. And you are very, you know, situated in that work, right? So you are a climate activist, you're a lawyer, you're an Indigenous person, you're from Guam, like you're facing so many of these issues in your own life, obviously, and doing so much work around that. And so I love what you said about, you know, how we need to listen and hear. I feel like that comes up in your book as well.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, wonderful. That's a wonderful introduction. I feel like we have situated ourselves here. Before we get into your very first pick, we will do a quick sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang. So this is an interesting love story. It's great for fans of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and High Fidelity. It's set in the mid-90s at NYU. And it follows young Wang, who has gotten the advice of love through Chinese numerology from his uncle. So he believes that he will have seven great loves in his life. And then he meets Irena in 95. And she's like the best. She's brilliant, charismatic, quick-witted, funny. They fall in love. But the thing is, she's number six. So if he is to have seven great loves, does that mean his time with Irina is going to come to an end? So this is a love letter to Western pop culture, Eastern traditions, and being a first-generation New Yorker. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang, for sponsoring this episode.
All right, so you have picked, yes, some fiction, some nonfiction, mostly fiction for us to talk about today. I'm super excited about your picks. Actually, this doesn't always happen when you do an interview, but you have picked at least two of the three are ones that I'm very familiar with. So I can't wait to hear you talk about them. It's always so lovely to hear what somebody else loves about a book that you love, right? Because it sometimes you see something new, or sometimes you just get to be like, yes, that's my feeling exactly. So
yeah, totally.
Yeah. So let's start with your first pick, which is Sharks in the Time of Saviors by Kawhi Strong Washburn.
Sure. So I'll just let you know now, you know, it was a task for sure to pick three and only three books, because yeah. I probably have read like just in the last like 6 months, like 30 that I love deeply. But I really wanted to pick three books that I read during at the height of the pandemic. That's the sort of how I went with my choice, you know, because I had been dealing with so much. I mean, the pandemic really obviously brought home sort of like all sort of manner of devastation, not only here in Guam, but across the country and indeed across the world. And I really, really needed books, arguably more than I ever have. So this first book, Sharks in the Time of Saviors, I just was not ready. I really wasn't prepared for how good it would be. And I mean that both at the sentence level, I think the writing was so so electrifying. And I also felt like as a writer, I think Kawhi Strong Washburn is just quite gifted, because he can slide into like, I mean, really, really charged sentences, like whole passages, whole pages, where it's almost like, you know, you feel your heart beating quicker. I mean, that's what good writing does. You know? It's bodily. You feel it at a cellular level, because you react so strongly to it, and then it glides, you know, into like a really soft landing with almost an exceeding amount of tenderness. And I just thought, this writer is gifted, and so I can't say enough good things about it. So the story is essentially a story about a working class Hawaiian Filipino family in the Hawaiian Islands who are faced with sort of like a lot of sort of huge change when they basically were on a vacation of like, and this is something that like local working families barely ever get to do, but they took a vacation on a boat, and then one of their youngest son, Nainoa, who's I guess you could say right the protagonist, the 7-year-old boy, he falls overboard, and instead of being mauled by the sharks, he's saved by them. And the writing, of course, around this scene is just gorgeous, but the sharks save him. And then that sort of starts, it catapults you into the story about a family that's sort of wrestling with all of those questions, you know, and they're all questions related to magic in one way or another, you know, and how the family is processing that. I mean, I don't know what you thought, but I mean, basically, it's a commentary on lots of things. On the one hand, it's almost like a commentary against the sort of like the singular savior narrative, right? Because this power. So I forgot to say, after he was saved by the sharks, Nainoa develops these sort of special gifts, and they're the gifts of healing. He would eventually go on to become study, I think, at Stanford, and then become an EMT in Portland. But his family drifts apart. They all the siblings do, because they're all struggling. I think there's a sentence in there from the sister's character where she talks about being like a sister, but strictly in the form of a shadow. She is like just nothing but her Nainoa's sister, you know? And the brother Dean, who's a great basketball player, and then he eventually goes to college in Spokane, they never name it, but it feels like it, they're talking about Gonzaga University. Yeah, you know, which is known for basketball. It's hilarious. But also, I think he's it's the same. They're trapped in the sense that they're both so great, the brother and the sister. They're great, and they have gifts of their own.
Yeah.
But they're so hampered by sort of and locked in this sort of like endless sort of battle, which is a battle of self and a battle of relations, you know, with not only with their brother Nainoa, but with their parents, who feel at times like they don't have enough love to give an equal measure and pass it around, you know. So they concentrate all their love on their son, and it's such a brilliant story. I mean, and clearly, I think I should just say this. I think like Marlon James, I think in his blurb, there was like a sentence. He said, love is in a ride or die with grief. And I was like, there you go. Because that's how the book felt to me. What did you think? I thought.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I agree with you. That book is doing the most all the time forever, right? Like there's so much going on. And also thank you for that corrected pronunciation of the author's name. I'm going to remember that, Kavai. And yeah, no, I was, as you were, so struck by the family relationships, you know, because I am actually a middle child myself, and I have a lot of sympathy for complicated sibling stories. And the way that each character in that book gets a voice, and the way we see what this, you know, as you said, the search for the single savior does to a family, to a person, because, you know, it's not all... It's not a bed of roses for Nainoa either, right? This is a really intensely damaging thing that happens to all of them, even as it has sort of beautiful moments as well. So, yeah, I think like everything you said is spot on. And yes, the sentence level is just stunning, stunning.
Right. It's also, God, if I can keep going, I sound like such a bang girl right now. But basically, Jen, that scene, even when like the mom and they're trying to reconcile or come to, and there's a depiction of the frogs outside that are making noise, the Koki frogs.
Ooh,
and
I got chills.
When I got to eat, me too. I literally started sobbing when I got to that very short sentence. The Koki frogs go. I was like, oh my God, because he had set it up so well that like, it's just a charge through my body and it's electrifying. I don't even know how to better describe that, but that was the scene. That was a perfect setup where it's like, you are so vested, you know, in this family, and you are rooting for them because they're going through a lot of you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. So I don't know if you have a lot of jobs already, but have you considered book reviewing? Because I think you'd be good at it.
Oh God, no, I never have. I don't even know how to. This is one of the first times I've ever actually been asked about my opinions about other books. So
well, you have great opinions. Okay. Nice. I feel like we could spend like 45 minutes talking about Sharks. We'll move on to the next one, which also is a book that is near and dear to my heart. I'm going to tell you that this book that you picked is the reason I have four roses planted in my garden.
So, wow.
True story. All right. So tell the people what your next pick is.
Okay, my next pick is How to Write an Autobiographical Novel by Alexander Chi, which is in and of itself hilarious because it's obviously not a how-to book.
Right.
You know, not at all. It's just a deep reflection of sort of the writing life, you know? Like it is so well done. I was like, I came to the party late. You know, the party, you know, of celebrating Alexander Chi and his genius. Like, I just didn't know enough about Alexander Chi before. I mean, I'd heard about his really famous books. It is Edinburgh and also Queen of the Night. But
yes,
this book is a gem. I can hardly articulate like why it matters so much to me. I mean, as a queer indigenous like person from Guam, like this is like a book that like within the first I think two chapters or I'm already aware as a reader that she actually spent a portion of his childhood in the islands In the island of Guam, on my island, and the surrounding island of Chuuk in the Federated States of Micronesia. These are places where famous writers like him, these are not places that are spoken about in the canon of literature. This is not in literature. I mean, and so like, these are places that I know deeply and dearly and love, you know, I mean, Guam, you know, I came of age here. And so like, to share that with the author, like, and to be so surprised by it was a nice thing. But in terms of the writing itself and the pieces, it's just a loose collection of, I think I watched an interview of him after I read it because I was so obsessed with how good it was. And he, I found out that he had about 70 essays or so to choose from. So the curation of that, like how he curated that, him and his editors, it's a fascinating story. I may never know, but the truth is it's the arrangement. It is like, wow, he arranged that. I mean, it makes music. And I mean, it has the classic coming of age stuff, like him being an exchange student in Mexico, passing for Mexican. He's also talks, it's a meditation on being like a mixed race. He's Korean American himself and gay. And other things, and but it's a whole life gem. It's like you, as you know, right? You read it and loved it. It's like him in the late '80s, early '90s, at the height of the AIDS epidemic in San Francisco, and like being on the receiving end of police batons. Like, so you have like all of this sort of like sweaty, laborious, sort of like lived experience, you know, distilled, right? And then you have all of, and then you have him working for, oh my God, the Buckleys, which is so interesting. And as a cater waiter, and also just being a writer who's teaching in the, like the day after like Trump is elected. And like, I mean, and there's like many moments. And so you see what's happening. It's like, it's this really, it's a meditation on like the life of a writer and one's relationship to writing. And I really appreciate Alexander Chi and his understand. Like, I think he thinks that, I mean, because there's this classic debate, right? Can you teach a writer good writing? Can you make writers, right? Are they born or are they made, et cetera? But he thinks, you know, that you can teach it. And but if you listen really like carefully, attentively to what he's really saying, like, I think part of his message is that the real writer, the true writer, is the one that lasts, the one that has enough stamina, the one that can bear it. It's like an emotional cavernousness, you know, like open-heartedness and an ability to bear a sort of an inordinate amount of sort of pain and suffering. I know that sounds awful, but
it's true.
But I think he's talking about bearing, the writer has to bear a writer's life, and that it feels so observant, but it feels so true after you read these essays. And while you're reading them, you have this sort of same bodily experience where it's like, I feel like when I was reading it, I wasn't just like reading a book from another. It was like given to me as a gift, but it was like an invitation, like a door swung open, you know? And he was like inviting me as a writer as well to walk through it and to really examine the hallways and to pick up the items, you know, like these are like sort of like, right? Like they're they're the content of his interior life, which he clearly has such an extraordinarily alive interior life. And I don't know, I love him. I don't even know him, but I feel love for him. It's on a deeper than average level, you know, sort of how much respect I have for him as a writer and as a human.
Isn't it amazing when those books come into your life? Like when you, just out of nowhere, somebody hands you something or you pick it up by accident and it just speaks to you on that level.
Yes. I mean, I don't know how often it happens for you. I mean, for me, it doesn't always happen, you know?
No. Yeah.
So, right. Yeah. So when
those
it
are
does,
special books.
Yes. It's so special. And I think it's because he's so, I don't know. And again, it's funny, right? Because I don't know him myself, but I just feel like he has an unusually capacious ability to pay attention, to be curious about life and what we're doing here, you know? And then his remarkable ability to write in such a way that it's so distilled. I mean, so many passages. Oh, did you think so, Jen? I thought so many passages were so distilled, you could call them poetry because they were just like a dropping. They had a sitting down sense.
Mm,
you know?
Yeah.
It's hard to explain. Yeah.
No, I know what you mean, though. He is a very... I like the idea of the distillation, right, of experience that he then manages to put on the page so simply and beautifully, that which is, right, what poetry does oftentimes. It's so interesting. This is, so I'm going to ask you sort of an unfair question because I'm putting you on the spot. But so I said, you know, that he, this collection, I think when people come to this collection, you know, very much so they find their piece, like there's the piece that stands out to them, maybe one or two pieces that's that really stick in their brain because they're the ones that like call to something, you know, in you that you're like, oh, there it is. It's expressed on the page. Like it's right there. And for me, one of those essays was the Rose Garden essay, which I forget that.
Oh, and that's why you planted the roses.
And that's why I planted the roses. Well, I don't know. I have always loved the idea of having roses, but you know, apartment life, right? Like I was very under the impression that you had to like know things, like you had to be good at whatever for roses to be a thing that you could do. So I was pretty convinced I would never have any roses of my own. And then I read that book. And actually, speaking of the pandemic, you know, there's this idea of pandemic purchases, right? My first pandemic purchase was a dwarf rose bush that sits in a pot. So you don't have to have a yard. And I was like, I can have beauty. I can nurture something. I can curate a plant experience for myself. Like I can give that to myself. And that was huge for me. And then the other one, and who knows if I'll ever actually do this, is he talks about being on the pilgrimage in Spain. And that is something that when I first learned about that pilgrimage in college, actually, I was like, oh, one day I'm going to do it. And I had kind of forgotten about it. And, you know, reading that essay where he's actually on part of it brought me back to that college self, right? Where I could be like, oh, right. Remember when I first learned about that and felt that call and like I had forgotten and now it's like awake again and you know maybe someday.
So
it sounds like the writing essays in particular, obviously you're a writer, right? Like and you're also working on memoir and those kinds of things, so do you feel like those were your essays?
I mean, so like on one level it's tempting to say for sure, like on becoming an American writer, you know, like it's like the really clear explicitly writer things, writerly sort of reflective pieces, but the roses piece is incredible. And actually the reason why I've been sort of thinking so much about roses lately actually is because another writer, Rebecca Solnit, has just come out with a book recently called Orwell's Roses.
I
just started it. Granted, if I had finished it, that would probably be on the list too, because I've heard her do an interview about why she wrote it. And this insistence on beauty, it's like an insistence on beauty, to insist on beauty. Mm. It's like to insist on life, no matter the hour, even at the hour of death. I mean, it is so, it feels vital. I mean, in the same way. So yes, so the roses essay, sorry, I'm going on a tangent.
That's okay.
I'm reading a lot lately.
You're fine.
So the querent also was beautiful. Like his meditation on being like a tarot card reader. Like there's so many things, you know, that stuck with me. So that was also this constant sort of ceaseless questing spirit, you know, like he is on the journey. Like, I mean, he's on the journey and he's filled with questions and the reader gets the benefit of sort of like looking at it, even from something as simple as sort of like, or not simple as reading tarot cards, right?
Yes.
It feels like this meditation interrogation. I don't know how to say this, but
yeah.
It just feels like he is searching and searching and it's so riveting because you're part of this experience and he's given it to you and assembled it in such a way where you realize that it's less about the answer, you know, it's about answering a question than it is about enlarging the question. It is like very, very arresting to me. Like I mean, his project, whatever it is, like, and I may disagree with how I've characterized his work, but I really deeply love it.
That's wonderful. Ugh, I feel like we could spend a lot of time talking about books, you and I. All right. All right. Well, I'm going to move us along a little bit here. Let's take another sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant Rivals to Lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, so before we go on to your third pick, let's talk about your book. So, No Country for Eight Spot Butterflies, the subtitle of this is a lyric essay, which I love, but also I feel like, well, it's many essays, right? And poems. There's a lot going on. So a lyric essay almost feels like a very simplified version of what this book is.
Well, in part, it's simplified version because it's almost impossible to articulate what the book is, which is hilarious. You know, it's a collection, though. It's a collection of writing.
Yes.
Writing that I have penned over the course of my life at different sort of particularly memorable moments, you know. Some of them are adapted from old journal entries that I wrote, for example, after working for Mother Teresa in India when I was a teenager. Just very young scraps of journals that I then sort of looked at for the first time. And some of them were essays, for example, op-eds that I wrote when my island of Guam was being threatened with ballistic missile attack from North Korea. And then, so like all of those are existential moments that are like clearly, you know, where you're asked to do the impossible. And that is to steel yourself for the possibility of oblivion. There's no way to do that, you know? And so a writer is like faced with these in these moments, you know, where you do ask some of the questions that she was asking in this book. What is the point of writing? Why are we called to do this? What are we doing here? And, you know, and it became clear to me that my book is a book about bearing witness, you know, whether or not, like in my daily life, I, you know, go about my work as a human rights lawyer. I'm largely in service of opposing the sort of large scale militarization of Guam by the United States. Guam remains a colony under American rule. And we have an independence movement here. We have been fighting sort of these just gargantuan forces, you know, and now in addition to climate change, this like it's Guam is on its way to becoming one of the most militarized places on the planet. And so I have to write about that and work on that in the day, but at night I have other questions, you know, and I realized I had to write because I couldn't breathe. I needed to collect the pieces that I've written about what it sort of feels like to be on the ground here in this community, but also like other pieces, larger, broader pieces about what it feels like as an Indigenous person in this country to bear witness to all that has befallen us, you know, and to really crystallize what matters to us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's what I'm trying to put forward in No Country. This just, it's a reflection, you know, on what matters most, you know, to Indigenous yeah. peoples, which is the earth and each other.
Yeah, I thought it was very powerful. I did. It helped that it was very short. I'm not going to lie. My attention span these days is sometimes stymied, but I loved it. It's a beautiful book, by the way. It's stunning. I love the cover design.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Just like very satisfying to hold in your hands. It has a nice.
That makes me feel really good. And also I'll just say the last thing is to me, it's like a full circle moment for me. I don't know like how to describe it, but my favorite living writers are Ndhati Roy, and she yes. wrote the introduction to the book, which is mind blowing.
I was gonna say like I was half expecting you to come into this interview with an Ndhati Roy pick, because you know clearly her work is very important to you, and she wrote the introduction to your book. Like I was like I wonder if that will happen. Oh
yeah, no, that's a good. That would have been logical, yeah, because her books clearly are among my favorite ever written. But yeah, I was super focused on for this interview on just really identifying those books that really helped me in a time that I desperately needed
yes,
help.
Yes.
And those are during the pandemic. And so that's why, for example, the books that I mentioned.
Yeah. Well, I just one more question before we move on to your last pick. So you said, you know, the Mother Teresa section, for example, is based on journal entries that you wrote. So have you been writing your whole life and then, you know, it sort of became part of your outlet, as you say, you know, to consider these questions, or was it something that developed later for you?
Oh, that's a great question. And actually weirdly complicated one, because I don't actually think I've been writing forever, right?
Yes.
But I didn't think of myself as a writer very consciously until recently. Like I was, you know, just writing to process sort of where, but in the book, you could say it was in some ways primarily written to process my own grief about what's been happening here. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so I think I've been a writer forever, although I didn't claim that identity very explicitly.
Sure. Well, I think it takes a lot of people. I mean, there's like a lot of imposter syndrome, and there's a lot of barriers to feeling like you are a writer, right? Capital W writer. So, yeah. Well, okay. So let's talk about your last pick, which is the one that's unfamiliar to me. So I'm looking forward to hearing about it from you.
Oh, sure. This is a different kind of book. I mean, it's very short. It's like it's a manifesto, really. And also program of action. It's called The Red Deal. Mm-hmm. So this is put out by the Red Nation, which is like an amazing national group that's really a collective of Indigenous people across the country that were really galvanized in the wake of the Dakota Access Pipeline, the Standing Rock movement. I mean, those like all of those players, you know, it's like a wide cast of characters. And these are just brave, fierce Indigenous land protectors and water defenders. And they got together, they formed an organization, they put out this incredibly beautiful book called The Red Deal. I mean, it's just short, it punches well above its weight, you know, and it's so clear-eyed. It's such a clear-eyed sort of diagnosis of how we got here, why we're in the mess that we're in, why the planet and its sort of natural life systems have been brought to its knees, to their knees. And that is because of sort of predatory global capitalism. Mm. I mean, this is the most overtly, obviously political of the three books, but I just think it was super important because we can't always be hedging our bets. And we cannot sit here and go, oh, on the one hand A and on the other hand B. And oh, this is so complicated. Sometimes it's not complicated. Mm. Sometimes it's clear. Sometimes we know very well who the perpetrator is, you know, and we have to point at him. Mm-hmm. And we have to know that, and we have to claim that. And the Red Nation has done exactly that. And they have put forward a beautiful book that both diagnoses sort of the the reasons, the sort of, they've explained very clearly how this prevailing economic model has brought it, well, is at war fundamentally with the life support systems of this planet that we inhabit and we share together. And on the it also goes further and maps out a plan of action, like one where it has several different features. For example, land back. It's not a metaphor, you know, this idea that actually we mean what we say when we say land back, and we mean it because indigenous peoples, and there's a ton of evidence to this, to this end, you know, that indigenous peoples, when they, when we are in control of our traditional lands, territories and resources, we are most equipped to actually steward them in a responsible, sustainable way that has the most chance of delivering sort of like a future inhabitable world to future generations, to our children and grandchildren. And so it's just very clear about that. I mean, it talks about the Green Deal as well, the Green New Deal, which is like an effort to, you know, I won't go into too much detail because I think we're over time already, but it actually talks about the importance of the Red New Deal. That, and this concept is this. I mean, I'm being a little simplistic. I'm painting with a very broad brush, but basically the idea is there is no solution to the climate crisis. Right. You know, there is no answer to the, sort of the environmental devastation without Indigenous liberation. So it foregrounds Indigenous liberation in a way that's very, very compelling and absolutely persuasive. And I adhere to those same sort of core principles. I would call them intellectual and political commitments, and I adhere to them. And so I love the book. And of course, I would love everyone to read it and to support the to support Red Media.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. I will be buying it based on that recommendation. You definitely sold it. And it sounds like something we all need to be reading. Absolutely.
Oh, thank you so much,
I do wish we could just keep talking about books indefinitely. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Will you tell the people where they can find you on the internet? Should they be interested in following more of your work?
Sure. I mean, I'm on Twitter, Julian Uggen. Also, if anyone's interested in pre-ordering ordering the book, they can go to Astor House, the website, or they can actually buy books wherever books are sold. I mean, it'll be everywhere. So, but please, you know, check it out. I mean, I would appreciate it.
Yes, absolutely. It is really beautiful. You're going to want to see it. It's a lovely book, everyone. So yeah. Well, again, thank you so much. This has just been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Jen.
And thanks everybody for listening. As always, we would love to hear your feedback at getbookedbookriot.com. And if you would like more recommendations, you can always get those at bookriot.com. You can find our other podcasts at bookriot.com/listen. And as per usual, if you leave us a rating and or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podchaser, wherever, it does help other folks to find the show. And you can find me, well, I'm on my social media break right now, but I might be back eventually on Twitter and Tumblr as Jen IRL and on Instagram as I am Jen IRL. And we will talk to you next time.